room stairs, and into the first storage room, where Morghenis produced a crystal sphere the size of a green apple. When he rubbed it, a small spark flickered into being at the center, gradually brightening until it limned the encircling casks and bundles with soft, honey-colored light. Morghenis shrouded the nether half of it in his sleeve and held it before him as they paced carefully through the stacked dry goods. The hatchway was closed. Simon did not remember whether or not he had shut it himself in his mad dash out. They went down the ladder carefully, Simon leading, Morghenis above him casting about this way and that with the shining globe. Simon pointed out the closet where Priorates had almost captured him. They passed on, down to the bottom floor. The lowermost room was as untenanted as before, but the door leading to the stone passageway was shut. Simon was almost positive that he had not done this, and told Morghenis so, but the little man just waved his hand and strode to the wall, finding the spot where the crack had been, according to Simon's directions. The doctor rubbed his hand in a circular movement across the wall, muttering something under his breath, but no crevice appeared. After Morghenis had squatted by the wall, talking to himself for some time, Simon grew tired of bouncing from one foot to the other and crouched down at the doctor's side. "Can't you just say some magic and make it open?" "No," Morghenis hissed. "A wise man never, I repeat, never, uses the art when he doesn't need to, especially when dealing with another adept, like our father Priorates. We might as well sign my name to it." As Simon sat back on his heels and scowled, the doctor placed his left hand flat in the middle of the area where the door had been. After a moment's light palpation of the surface, he hit it smartly with the heel of his right hand. The door popped open, pouring torchlight into the room. The doctor peeked through, then dropped his lamp crystal into the hem of his voluminous sleeve and pulled out a stitched leather bag. "Ah, Simon, lad," he chuckled quietly. "What a thief I would have made. It was not a magic door, only hidden by use of the art. Come on now." They stepped through into the damp stone corridor. Their footfalls made syrupy echoes as they slipped and stepped down the walkway to the corridor's end and locked door. After a moment's examination of the lock, Morghenis stepped to the peephole and peered inside. "I think you're right, lad," he hissed. "Nuani's shinbone, but I wish you weren't." He returned to the scrutiny of the lock. "Run up to the end of the corridor and keep an ear open, won't you?" As Simon stood guard, Morghenis fished around in his leather bag, at last extracting a long, needle-thin blade set in a wooden handle. He waved it merrily at Simon. "A Raxi pig sticker. Knew it would come in useful one day." He tested it against the keyhole. It slid into the aperture with room to spare. He removed it and shook a tiny jar from his bag, which he uncorked with his teeth. As Simon watched, fascinated, Morghenis upended the jar and poured a dark, sticky substance onto the needle blade, then quickly poked the tip back into the keyhole. It left glistening traces as it passed into the lock. Morghenis wiggled the pig sticker for a moment, then stepped back and counted on his fingers. When he had tallied both hands 3 times each, he grasped the slender handle and twisted. He grimaced and let go. "Come here, Simon. We need your strong young arms." At the doctor's direction, Simon grasped the strange tool by the butt end and began to twist. For a moment, his sweaty palms slipped on the polished wood. He tightened his grip and after a short interval felt something catch inside the lock. An instant later, he heard the bolt slide back. Morghenis nodded his head and Simon shouldered the door open. The smoldering rushes in the wall socket threw only faint light. As Simon and the doctor approached, they saw the shackled figure at the rear of the cell look up, and his eyes widened slowly, as if in some kind of recognition. His mouth worked, but only a scratchy huff of breath came out. The smell of wet, foul straw was overwhelming. "Oh, oh, my poor Prince Joshua," Morghenis said, as the doctor gave a quick inspection to Joshua's manacles. Simon could only look on, feeling as helpless to affect the rush of events as if he dreamed. The prince was achingly thin, and bearded like a roadside doom-crier. The parts of his skin that showed through the miserable sacking were covered with red sores. Morghenis was whispering in Joshua Lackhand's ear. He had again produced his bag, and held in his hand a shallow pot, the sort that ladies kept for their lip paint. Briskly rubbing something from the pot on first one palm, then the other, the little doctor once more looked over Joshua's restraints. Both arms were shackled to a massive iron ring in the wall, one manacled about the wrist, the handless other by a cuff about the prince's thin upper arm. Morghenis finished smearing his hands and passed pot and bag to Simon.
"Now be a good lad," he said, "and cover your eyes. I traded a silk-bound volume of Plessinin Mermanus, the only one north of Perdruin, for this muck. I just hope... Simon, do cover your eyes!"
As the youth raised his hands, he saw Morghenis reaching for the ring that bound the prince's chains to the stone. An instant later, a flash of light glared pinkly through Simon's meshed fingers, accompanied by a crack like hammer on slate. When the youth looked again, Prince Joshua lay with his chains in a heap on the floor, and Morghenis kneeled beside him, palms smoking. The wall ring was blackened and twisted like a burnt bannock.
"Phew!" the doctor gasped. I hope I never have to do that again. Can you pick up the prince, Simon? I am very weak."
Joshua rolled stiffly over and looked around.
"I think I can walk. Priorities gave me something."
"Nonsense!" Morghenis took a deep breath and climbed shakily to his feet. "Simon is a strong lad. Come on, boy, don't gape. Pick him up!"
After some maneuvering, Simon managed to wrap the hanging strands of Joshua's chains, still attached at wrist and arm, into a loop around the prince's waist. Then, with Morghenis' assistance, he somehow hoisted Joshua up like a pick-a-back child. He stood and sucked in a great draught of air. For a moment, he feared he could not bear up, but with a clumsy hop he moved Joshua higher on his back, and found that even with the added weight of the chains it was not impossible.
"Wipe that silly smile off your face, Simon," the doctor said. "We still have to get him up the ladder."
Somehow they managed, Simon grunting, almost weeping with the exertion. Joshua pulling weakly at the rungs, Morghenis pushing behind and whispering encouragement. It was a long, nightmarish climb, but at last they reached the main storeroom. Morghenis scurried past as Simon leaned against a bale to rest, the prince still clinging to his back.
Somewhere,
Morghenis muttered, pushing his way between the close-stacked goods. When he reached the southern wall of the room, shining his crystal before him, he began to search in earnest.
"What?"
Simon started to ask, but the doctor silenced him with a gesture. As they watched Morghenis appear and disappear behind piles of barrels, Simon felt a delicate touch on his hair. The prince was patting gently at his head.
"Real? Real?" Joshua breathed.
Simon felt something wet run down his neck.
"Found it!" came Morghenis' hushed but triumphant cry. "Come along!"
Simon rose, staggering a little, and carried the prince forward. The doctor was standing beside the blank stone wall, gesturing toward a pyramid of large casks. The lamp crystal gave him the shadow of a looming giant.
"Found what?"
Simon adjusted the prince and stared.
"Barrels? Indeed!"
the doctor cackled. With a flourish, he twisted the round rim of the topmost cask a half turn. The whole side of the barrel swung open, as if it were a door, revealing cavernous darkness beyond. Simon stared suspiciously.
"What's that?" "A passageway, you foolish boy."
Morghenis took his elbow and guided him toward the open-sided barrel, which stood scarcely more than chest high.
"This castle is honeycombed with such secret byways."
With a frown, Simon stooped, peering at the black depths beyond.
"In there?"
Morghenis nodded. Simon, realizing he could not walk through, got down on his knees to inch inside, the prince riding his back as if he were a festival pony.
"I didn't know there were such passages in the storerooms," he said, his voice echoing in the barrel.
Morghenis leaned down to guide Joshua's head under the low entrance.
"Simon, there are more things you don't know than there are things that I do know. I despair of the imbalance. Now close your mouth and let's hurry."
They were able to stand again on the far side. Morghenis' crystal revealed a long, angled corridor, unremarkable but for a fabulous accumulation of dust.
"Ah, Simon," Morghenis said as they hurried along. "I only wish I had time to show you some of the rooms past which this hallway creeps. Some were the chambers of a very great, very beautiful lady. She used this passage to keep her secret assignations."
The doctor looked up at Joshua, whose face lay against Simon's neck.
"Sleeping now," Morghenis murmured. "All sleeping."
The corridor climbed and dipped, turning one way and another. They passed many doors, some whose locks were rusted shut, some whose handles were as shiny as a new fitting piece. Once they passed a series of small windows. In a brief glance, Simon was startled to see the sentries on the western wall silhouetted against the sky. The clouds were tinted a faint rose where the sun had gone.
"We must be above the dining hall," Simon marveled. "When did we do all the climbing?"
They were stumbling in exhaustion when Morghenis finally stopped. There were no windows in this part of the winding corridor, only tapestries. Morghenis lifted one, revealing grey stone beneath.
"Wrong tapestry," the doctor panted,
lifting the next one to reveal a door of rough wood. He laid his ear against it and listened for a moment, then pulled it open.
"Hall of Records," he gestured at the torchlit hallway beyond. "Only a few 100 paces from my chambers."
When Simon and his passenger had come through, he let the door swing shut behind. It closed with an authoritative bump. Looking back, Simon could not distinguish it from other wooden panels that lined the corridor wall. There was only one last dash to be made in the open, a relatively rapid sprint from the easternmost door of the archive rooms across the open commons. As they lurched across the shadowed grass, staying as close to the walls as they could without tripping through the ivy, Simon thought he saw a movement in the shadows of the wall across the yard, something large that shifted slightly as though to watch their passage, a familiar, stoop-shouldered form. But the light was dying fast, and he could not be sure. It was only one more black spot moving before his eyes. He had a stitch in his side that felt as though someone had caught his rib with Reuben's foundry tongs. Morghenis, who had limped ahead, held the door open. Simon tottered through, carefully put his burden down, then pitched full length on the cool flagstones, sweaty and breathless. The world spun about him in a giddy dance.
"Here, your highness, drink this. Go on," he heard Morghenis say.
After some little while, he opened his eyes and lifted himself on one elbow. Joshua sat propped against the wall. Morghenis crouched over him, holding a brown ceramic jug.
"Better?"
the doctor asked. The prince nodded weakly.
"Stronger already. This liquor feels like what Priratis gave me, but not so bitter. Said that I was weakening too fast, that they needed me tonight."
"Needed you? I don't like the sound of that, not at all."
Morghenis brought the jug over to Simon. The drink was busy and sour to the taste, but warming. The doctor peered out the door, then dropped the bolt.
"Tomorrow is Beltane Day, the 1st of May, he said. Tonight is a very bad night, my prince. Stoning night, it is called."
Simon felt the doctor's liquor burning pleasantly as it moved down to his stomach. The ache in his joints lessened, as though a twisted length of cloth had been slackened a turn or two. He sat up, feeling dizzy.
"I find it ominous, their needing you on such a night," Morghenis repeated. I fear worse things even than the imprisoning of the king's brother.
The imprisoning itself was bad enough for me. A wry grimace stretched Joshua's gaunt features, then disappeared. Deep lines of sorrow took its place. Morghenis, he said a moment later, his voice cracking. Those whoreson bastards killed my men. They ambushed us. The doctor raised his hand as though to grasp the prince's shoulders, then put it awkwardly back down.
I'm sure, my lord, I'm sure. Do you know for certain whether your brother was responsible? Could it have been Priorates acting alone?
Joshua shook his head wearily. I don't know. The men who attacked us wore no insignia, and I never saw anyone but the priest once I was brought here. But it is astonishing to consider Priorates doing such a thing without Elias.
True, but why?
Why, damn them? I do not covet power. The reverse, if anything. You know that, Morghenis. Why should they do this?
My prince, I am afraid I do not have the answers right this instant. But I must say this goes far toward confirming my suspicions about other things. About northern matters. Do you remember hearing of the white foxes?
Morghenis' tone was significant, but the prince only cocked an eyebrow and said nothing.
Well, there is no time to spend talking of my fears at this moment. Our time is short, and we must attend to more immediate matters.
Morghenis helped Simon up from the floor, then went puttering off in search of something. The youth stood looking shyly at Prince Joshua, who remained slumped against the wall, eyes closed. The doctor returned with a hammer, its head rounded by much use and a chisel.
Strike off Joshua's chains, will you, lad? I have a few things left to attend to.
He scuttled off again.
Your Highness?
Simon said quietly, approaching the prince. Joshua opened bleary eyes and stared first at the youth, then at the tools he carried. He nodded. Kneeling at the prince's side, he burst the lock on the band that encircled Joshua's right arm with a pair of sharp blows. As he moved round to the prince's left, Joshua opened his eyes again and laid a restraining hand on Simon's arm. Take only the chain from this side, young one. A ghostly smile flickered across his face. Leave me the shackle to remember my brother by. Leave me his band. He displayed the puckered stump of his right wrist. We have a sort of tally system, you see. Simon, suddenly chilled, trembled as he braced Joshua's left forearm against the stone flags. With a single stroke he sliced through the chain, leaving the cuff of blackened iron above the hand. Morghenis appeared, carrying a bundle of dark clothing.
Come, Joshua, we must hurry. It is almost an hour after dark, and who knows when they will go looking for you. I broke my lockpick off in the door, but that will not long prevent them discovering your absence.
What will we do? Asked the prince, standing unsteadily on his feet, as Simon helped him into the musty peasant gear. Who in the castle can we trust?
Nobody at present, not on such short notice. That is why you must make your way to Naglimund. Only there will you be safe.
Naglimund, Joshua seemed bemused. I have dreamed so often of my home there, in these horrible months. But no, I must show the people my brother's duplicity. I will find strong arms to aid me.
Not here, not now.
Morghenis' voice was firm, his bright eyes commanding.
You will find yourself back in a dungeon, and this time you will go quickly to a private beheading. Don't you see? You must get to a strong place where you are safe from treachery before you can press any claim. Many kings have imprisoned and killed their relatives. Most got away with it. It takes more than familial infighting to excite the populace.
Well, said Joshua, reluctantly, even if you are correct, how would I escape? A fit of coughing shook him. The castle gates are doubtless closed for the night. Should I walk up to the inner gate dressed as a traveling minstrel and try to sing my way out? Morgaini smiled. Simon was impressed by the spirit of the grim prince, who an hour before had been chained in a damp cell with no hope of rescue.
As it happens, you have not caught me unprepared with that question, the doctor said. Please observe.
He walked to the back of the long chamber, to the corner where Simon had once cried against the rough stone wall. He gestured to the star chart, whose connected constellations formed a four-winged bird. With a little bow, he swept the chart aside. Behind it lay a great square hole cut into the rock, set with a wooden door.
As I demonstrated already, Priorates is not the only one with hidden doors and secret passages.
The doctor chuckled.
Father Redcape is a newcomer, and has much yet to learn about the castle that has been my home for longer than you two could guess.
Simon was so excited that he could hardly stand still, but Joshua's expression was doubtful.
Where does it go, Morgaini's? He asked.
It will do me scant good to escape Elias' dungeon and rack, only to find myself in the Hayholt's moat. Never fear. This castle is built on a warren of caves and tunnels, not to mention the ruins of the older castle beneath us. The whole maze is so vast that even I do not know the half of it. But I know it well enough to give you safe passage out. Come with me.
Morgaini's led the prince, who went leaning on Simon's arm, over to the chamber-spanning table. There he spread out a rolled parchment, whose edges were grey and feathery with age.
You see, said Morgaini's, I have not been idle while my young friend Simon here was at supper. This is a plan of the catacombs, of necessity only a partial one, but with your route marked. If you follow this carefully, you will find yourself above ground at last, in the lich yard, beyond the walls of Urchester. From there, I am sure you can find your way to safe haven for the night.
After they had studied the map, Morgaini's pulled Joshua aside, and the two of them engaged in whispered conversation. Simon, feeling more than a little left out, stood and examined the doctor's chart. Morgaini's had marked the path with bright red ink. His head swam following the twists and turns. When the two men finished their discussion, Joshua collected the map.
Well, old friend, he said, if I am to go, then I should go quickly. It would be unwise for another hour to find me still here in the Hayholt. I shall think carefully on these other things you have told me.
His gaze swept around the cluttered room. I only fear what your brave acts might bring down on you.
There is nothing you can do about that, Joshua, Morgaini's replied. And I am not without some defenses of my own. A few feints and tricks I can employ. As soon as Simon told me about finding you, I began to make some preparations. I have long feared that my hand would be forced. It has only been hastened slightly by this. Here, take this torch.
So saying, the little doctor removed a brand from the wall and gave it to the prince, next handing him a sack that hung next to it on a hook.
I have put some food in here for you, and some more of the curative liquor. It is not much, but you must travel light. Please hurry.
He held the star chart up and away from the doorway.
Send word to me soon as you are safe at Naglimund, and I will have more things to tell.
The prince nodded, limping slowly into the corridor mouth. The torch's flame pushed his shadow far down the dark shaft as he turned back.
I will never forget this, Morgaini's, he said. And you, young man, you have done a brave thing today. I hope it will be the making of your future someday.
Simon knelt, embarrassed by the emotions he felt. The prince looked so haggard and grim. He felt pride, sorrow, and fear all pulling at him, his thoughts stirred and muddied.
Fare you well, Joshua, Morgaini said,
resting a hand on Simon's shoulder. Together they watched the prince's torch recede down the low passageway until it was swallowed by the murk. The doctor pulled the door shut and dropped the hanging back into place.
Come, Simon, he said then. We still have much to do. Priorates is missing his guest this stoning night, and I cannot think he will be pleased.
An interval crept by in silence. Simon dangled his feet from his perch on the tabletop, frightened but nevertheless savoring the excitement that charged the room, that now hung over all of the staid old castle. Morghenis fluttered back and forth past him, hurrying from one incomprehensible task to another.
I did most of this while you were eating, you see, but there are still a few things left, a few unknotted ends.
The little man's explanation enlightened Simon not one whit, but things had been happening fast enough to satisfy even his impatient nature. He nodded and dangled his feet some more.
Well, I suppose that's all I can do tonight, Morghenis said at last. You had better wander back and go to bed. Come here early in the morning, perhaps right after you do your chores.
Chores? Gasped Simon. Chores? Tomorrow?
Certainly, snapped the doctor. You don't think anything out of the ordinary is going to happen, do you? Do you suppose that the king is going to announce, oh, by the way, my brother escaped from the dungeon last night, so we'll all have a holiday and go look for him? You don't think that, do you?
No, I...
And you would certainly not say, Rachel, I can't do my chores because Morghenis and I are plotting treason, would you?
Of course not.
Good. Then you will do your chores and come back as soon as you can. And then we will assess the situation. This is far more dangerous than you realize, Simon. But I am afraid you are now a part of things, for good or for ill. I had hoped to keep you out of all this.
Out of all what? Part of what, Doctor?
Never mind, boy. Isn't your plate full enough already? I'll try to explain what I safely can tomorrow. But stoning night is not the best occasion to speak of things like...
Morghenis' words were chopped short by a loud pounding at the outer door. For a moment, Simon and the doctor stood staring at one another. After a pause, the knocking was repeated.
Who's there?
Morghenis called, in a voice so calm Simon had to look again at the fear showing on the little man's face.
Hench, came the reply.
Morghenis visibly relaxed.
Go away, he said. I told you I didn't need you tonight.
There was a brief silence.
Doctor,
Simon whispered,
I think I saw Inch earlier.
The dull voice came again.
I think I left something. Left it in your room, Doctor.
Come back and get it another time, Morghenis called,
and this time the irritation was genuine.
I'm far too busy to be disturbed right now.
Simon tried again.
I think I saw him when I was carrying just...
Open this door immediately in the king's name.
Simon felt cold despair grip his stomach. This new voice did not belong to Inch.
By the lesser crocodile,
Morghenis swore in soft wonderment.
The cow-eyed dullard has sold us out. I didn't think he had the sense. I will be disturbed no longer,
he shouted then, jumping to the long table and straining to push it in front of the bolted inner door.
I am an old man, and need my rest.
Simon leaped to help, his terror mixed with an inexplicable rush of exhilaration. A third voice called from the hallway, a cruel, hoarse voice.
Your rest will be a long one indeed, old man.
Simon stumbled and nearly fell as his knees buckled beneath him. Priorates was here. A hideous crunching noise began to echo through the inner hallway, as Simon and the doctor finally slid the heavy table into place.
Axes,
said Morghenis, and sprang along the table in search of something.
Doctor,
Simon hissed, bouncing up and down in fright. The sound of splintering wood reverberated outside.
What can we do?
He whirled to find himself confronted with a scene of madness. Morghenis was up on his knees on the tabletop, crouching beside an object that Simon recognized after an instant as a birdcage. The doctor had his face pressed close against the slender bars. He was cooing and muttering to the creatures within, even as Simon heard the outer door crash down.
What are you doing?
Simon gasped. Morgainis hopped down, carrying the cage, and trotted across the room to the window. At Simon's yelp, he turned to look calmly at the terrified youth, then smiled sadly and shook his head.
Of course, boy, he said. I must make provision for you too, just as I promised your father. How little time we had.
He set the cage down and scuttled back to the table, where he groped about in the clutter even as the chamber door began to rock with the impact of heavy blows. Harsh voices could be heard, and the clatter of men in armor. Morgainis found what he sought, a wooden box, and upended it, dumping some shining golden thing into his palm. He began to move back to the window, then stopped and retrieved also a sheaf of thin parchments from the chaos of the tabletop.
Take this, will you please?
He said, handing the bundle to Simon as he hurried back to the window.
It's my life of Prester John, and I begrudge Priorates the pleasure of criticism.
Stupefied, Simon took the papers and tucked them into his waistband beneath his shirt. The doctor reached into the cage and removed one of its small inhabitants, cupping it in his hand. It was a tiny silver-gray sparrow. As Simon watched in numb astonishment, the doctor calmly tied the shiny bauble, a ring, to the sparrow's leg with a bit of twine. A tiny scrap of parchment was bound already to its other leg.
"Be strong with this heavy burden," he said quietly, speaking, it seemed, to the little bird.
The blade of an axe crashed through the heavy door just above the bolt. Morgainis bent over and picked a long stick up off the floor and broke the high window, then lifted the sparrow to the sill and let it go. The bird hopped along the frame for a moment, then took wing and disappeared into the evening sky. One by one, the doctor released five more sparrows that way, until the cage stood empty. A large piece had been bitten from the door's center. Simon could see the angry faces and the flare of torchlight on metal beyond. The doctor beckoned.
The tunnel, boy, and quickly!
Behind them, another ragged chunk of wood tore loose and clattered to the floor. As they sped across the room, the doctor handed Simon something small and round.
Rub this and you will have light, Simon, he said. It is better than a torch.
He swept the hanging aside and pulled the door open.
Go on, hurry, look for the Tanja stairs, then climb.
As Simon entered the corridor mouth, the great door sagged on its hinges and collapsed. Morgainis turned.
But doctor, Simon shouted, come with me, we can escape.
The doctor looked at him and smiled, shaking his head. The table before the doorway was overturned with a smash of glass, and a group of armed men in green and yellow began to push past the wreckage. In the midst of the Erkin Guard, crouched like a toad in a garden of swords and axes, was Breogar, the Lord Constable. In the littered hallway stood the bulky form of Inch. Behind him, Priorati's cloak flashed scarlet.
Stop!
A voice thundered through the room. Simon was still able to marvel, in the midst of all his fear and confusion, that such a sound could come from Morgaini's frail body. The doctor stood now before the Erkin Guard, fingers splayed in a strange gesture. The air began to bend and shimmer between the doctor and the startled soldiers. The very substance of nothingness seemed to grow solid as Morgaini's hands danced strange patterns. For a moment, the torches outlined the scene before Simon's eyes as if it were frozen on an ancient tapestry.
Bless you, boy, Morgainis hissed. Go, now!
Simon retreated another step down the corridor. Priorates pushed past the stunned guards, a blurry red shadow behind the wall of air. One of his hands stabbed forth, a seething, coruscating web of blue sparks marked where it touched the thickening air. Morgainis reeled, and his barrier began to melt like a sheet of ice. The doctor bent and swept up a pair of beakers from a rack on the floor.
Stop that, youth!
Priorates shouted, and suddenly Simon could see his eyes above the scarlet cloak. Cold, black eyes. Serpentine eyes that seemed to hold him, transfix him. The shimmering pane of air dissolved.
Take them!
Spat Count Breogar, and the soldiers surged forward. Simon watched in sick fascination, wanting to run but unable to. Nothing between him and the Erkin Guard swords but Morgainis.
Enki anno kai shi igao,
the doctor's voice boomed and tolled like a bell made of stone. A wind shrieked through the chamber, flattening and extinguishing the torches. In the center of the maelstrom, Morgaini stood, a flask in each outstretched hand. In the brief instant of darkness, there was a crash, then a flare of incandescence, as the glass beakers shattered into flame. In a heartbeat, fiery streams were running down the arms of Morgaini's cloak, and then his head was haloed in leaping, crackling tongues of fire. Simon was buffeted by terrible heat as the doctor turned to him once more. Morgaini's face seemed already to shift and change behind the blazing mist that enveloped it.
"Go, my Simon," he breathed, and he was voiced in flame. "It is too late for me. Go to Joshua."
As Simon staggered backward in horror, the doctor's frail form leaped with burning radiance. Morgaini's wheeled. Taking a few halting steps, he threw himself with outspread arms onto the screeching, quailing guardsmen, who tore at each other in their desperation to escape back through the broken doorway. Hellish flames billowed upward, blackening the groaning roof beams. The very walls began to shudder. For a brief moment, Simon heard the harsh, choking voice of Priorates, intertwined with the sounds of Morgaini's final agonies. Then there was a great crack of light and an ear-thumping roar. A hot whip of air flung Simon down the passageway, blowing the door shut behind him with a noise like the hammer of judgment. Stunned, he heard the grinding, splintering shriek of the roof timbers collapsing. The door shuddered, wedged shut by many thousand weight of scorched oak and stone. For a long time, he lay racked with sobs, the tears of his eyes sucked away by the heat. At last, he crawled to his feet. He found the warm stone wall with his hand and went stumbling down into darkness. Chapter 13. Between Worlds. Voices, many voices, whether birthed in his own head or in the comfortless shadows that surrounded him, Simon could not tell, were his only companions in that first terrible hour.
"Simon Mooncalf. Done it again. Simon Mooncalf. His friend is dead. His only friend. Be kind. Be kind. Where are we? In darkness. In darkness forever. To bat flitter like a lost, shrieking soul through the endless tunnels. He is Simon Pilgrim now, doomed to wander. To wander."
"No," Simon shuddered, trying to rein in the clamoring voices. "I will remember. I will remember the red line on the old map, and to look for the Tanja stairs, whatever they might be. I will remember the flat black eyes of that murderer Priorates. I will remember my friend, Dr. Morgaini's."
He sank down onto the gritty tunnel floor, weeping with helpless, strengthless anger. A barely beating heart of life in a universe of black stone. The blackness was a choking thing that pressed down on him, squeezing out his breath.
Why did he do it? Why didn't he run? He died to save you, idiot boy, and Joshua. If he had run, they would have followed. Priorates had the stronger magic. You would have been caught, and they would have been free to follow the prince. To hunt him down and drag him back to his cell. Morgaini's died for that.
Simon hated the sound of his own crying, the hacking, sniveling sound echoing on and on. He pushed it all up from inside him, sobbing until his voice was a dry rasp, a sound he could live with, not the weepy bleat of a lost Mooncalf in the dark. Lightheaded and sick, wiping his face with his shirt sleeve, Simon felt the forgotten weight of Morgaini's crystal sphere in his hand. Light. The doctor had given him light, along with the papers crimped uncomfortably in the waistband of his breeches. It was the last gift the doctor had given him.
"No," a voice whispered. "The second to last, Simon Pilgrim."
Simon shook his head, trying to dispel the licking, murmuring fear. What had Morgaini said as he tied the glinting bauble to the sparrow's slender leg, to be strong with its heavy burden? Why was he sitting in the pitch dark, mewling and dribbling? Wasn't he Morgaini's apprentice, after all? He clambered to his feet, dizzy and trembling. He felt the glassy surface of the crystal warm beneath his stroking fingers. He stared into the darkness where his hands must be, thinking of the doctor. How could the old man laugh so often, when the world was so full of hidden treachery, of beautiful things with rot inside of them? There was so much shadow, so little. A pinprick of light flared before him, a needle hole in the sun-shrouding curtain of night. He rubbed harder and stared. The light bloomed, folding back the shadows. The passageway's walls leapt out on either side, brushed with glowing amber. Air seemed to rush into his lungs. He could see. The momentary elation evaporated as he turned to look up and down the corridor. A pain in his head made the walls waver before his gaze. The tunnel was nearly featureless, a lonely hole burrowing down to the underbelly of the castle, festooned with pale cobwebs. Back up the passage he could see a crossway he had already passed, a gaping mouth in the wall. He walked back. A quick shine of the crystal revealed nothing beyond the opening but tailings and rubble, a sloping pile of debris leading down out of reach of the sphere's thin light. How many other cross paths had he missed? And how would he know which ones were the right ones? Another wave of choking hopelessness washed over him. He was hopelessly alone, hopelessly lost. He would never find himself back in the world of light. Simon Pilgrim, Simon Mooncalf, family dead, friend dead, see him wander and wander forever. Silence! He growled out loud, and was startled to hear the word caroming down the path before him, a messenger carrying a proclamation from the King of Under the Ground. Silence! 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 King Simon of the Tunnels began his staggering progress. The passageway squirmed downward into the stone heart of the Hayholt, a smothering, winding, cobwebbed track lit only by the gleam of Morgaini's crystal sphere. Broken spiderwebs performed a slow, ghostly dance in the wake of his passage. When he turned to look back, the strands seemed to wave after him, like the clutching, boneless fingers of the drowned. Hanks of silky thread stuck to his hair and draped stickily across his face, so that he had to hold his hand before his eyes as he walked. Often he would feel some small, leggy thing scuttling away across his fingers as he broke through its netting, and would have to stop for a moment, head down until the shivers of disgust subsided. It was becoming colder, and the close, cramped walls of the passageway seemed to breathe with moisture. Parts of the tunnel had crumbled. In some places, dislodged dirt and stone were piled so high in the center of the path that he had to push his back against the damp walls and edge around them. He was doing just that, squeezing around an obstruction, the light-wielding hand held over his head, the other feeling before him for a way past, when he felt a searing pain, like a thousand needle pricks, run up his questing hand and onto his arm. A flash of the crystal brought a vision of horror. Hundreds, no, thousands of tiny white spiders swarming up his wrist and under his shirt sleeve, biting like a thousand burning fires. Simon shrieked and slammed his arm against the tunnel wall, bringing a shower of clotted dirt down into his mouth and eyes. His terrified shouts echoed down the passageway, quickly failing. He fell to his knees in damp soil, smacking his stinging arm up and down into the dirt until the flaring pain began to subside, then crawled forward on his hands and knees, away from whatever horrible nest or den he had disturbed. As he crouched and frantically scrubbed his arm with loose soil, the tears came again, racking him like a whipping. When he could stand to look at his arm, the crystal's light revealed only reddening and swelling skin beneath the dirt, instead of the bloody wounds he had been sure he would find. The arm throbbed, and he wondered dully if the spiders were poisonous, if the worst was yet to come. When he felt the sobs climbing once more in his chest, shortening his breath, he forced himself to his feet. He must go on. He must. 1,000 white spiders. He must go on. He He followed the sphere's dim light downward. It gleamed on moisture-slick stone and earth-choked cross-corridors, twining with pallid roots. Surely he must be far below the castle by now, far down into the black earth. There was no sign of Joshua's passage, or of anyone's. He was sickeningly certain he had missed some turning place in the darkness and confusion, and was even now spiraling downward into an inescapable pit. He had trudged on so long, making so many twists and turns, that the memory of the narrow red line on Morgani's old parchment was now useless. There was nothing remotely like stairs anywhere in these narrow, strangling wormholes. Even the glowing crystal was beginning to flicker. The voices escaped his control again, surrounding him in the crazy shadows like a shouting throng. Dark and getting darker. Dark and getting darker. Let us lie down for a while. We want to sleep, just for a while. Sleep. The king has an animal inside him, and Priorates is its keeper. My Simon? Morgani's called you. My Simon. He knew your father. He kept secrets. Joshua is going to Naglimond. The sun shines there all day and night. Naglimond. They eat sweet cream and drink clear, shining water at Naglimond. The sun is bright. Bright and hot. It is hot. Why? The damp tunnel was suddenly very warm. He stumbled on, hopelessly sure that he felt the first fever of spider poison. He would die in the dark, the terrible dark. He would never again see the sun or feel its... The warmth seemed to push into his lungs. It was getting hotter. Stifling air enfolded him, sticking his shirt to his chest and his hair to his forehead. He felt a moment of even greater panic. Have I circled round? Have I walked for years only to come back to the ruins of Morgani's chamber, the burned, blackened remains of his life? But it was not possible. He had been going downward steadily, never once mounting back to anything more than a moment's level going. Why was it so hot? The memory of one of Shem Horsegroom's stories pushed forward, a story of young Prester John wandering through darkness toward a great, brooding heat. The dragon Shurike in its lair beneath the castle. This castle. But the dragon is dead. I've touched its bones. A yellow chair in the throne room. There is no dragon anymore. No sleepless, deep-breathing red hulk the size of the tawny field, waiting in the darkness with claws like swords, and a soul as old as the stones of Ostenard. The dragon is dead. But did dragons never have brothers? And what was that sound, that dull, grumbling roar? The heat was oppressive, and the air was thick with itching smoke. Simon's heart was a lump of dull lead in his chest. The crystal began to dim as broad smears of reddish light blotted out the sphere's weaker radiance. The tunnel flattened, turning now neither left nor right, leading down a long eroded gallery to an arched doorway that danced with a flickering orange radiance. Shivering despite the sweat streaming down his face, Simon felt himself drawn toward it. Turn and run, Mooncalf! He could not. Each step was a labor, but he moved closer. He reached the archway and craned his neck fearfully around the portal's rim. It was a great cavern, awash in leaping light. The rock walls seemed to have melted and set like wax at the base of a candle, the stone smoothed in long vertical ripples. For a moment, Simon's light-stunned eyes opened wide in amazement. At the cavern's far side, a score of dark figures were kneeling before the shape of a monstrous, flame-blazing dragon. An instant later, he saw that it was not so. The huge shape crouched against the stone was a great furnace. The dark-clad figures were forking logs into its flaming maw. The foundry! The castle foundry! All around the cavern, heavily dressed and scarf-masked men were smithying the tools of war. Massive buckets of glowing liquid iron were pulled from the flames on the ends of long poles. Molten metal jumped and hissed as it drizzled into plate-shaped molds, and above the groaning voice of the furnace reverberated the clang of hammer on anvil. Simon shrank back from the doorway. For a heartbeat, he had felt himself about to leap forward and run to these men, for men they were, despite their strange dress. It had seemed in that instant that anything was better than the dark tunnel and the voices, but he knew better. Did he think these foundry men would help him to escape? Doubtless they knew only one route from the blazing cavern, up and back, into the clutches of Priorates. If he had survived the inferno of Morgani's chambers, or the brutal justice of Elias. He sank down onto his haunches to think. The noise of the furnace and his own painful head made it difficult. He could not remember passing any cross tunnels for some time. He could see what looked like a row of holes along the far wall of the foundry cavern. It could be that they were nothing but storage chambers or dungeons. But it seemed just as likely that they were other routes in and out of the chamber. To retreat back up the tunnel seemed foolish. Coward! Scullion! Numb, battered, he balanced on the knife edge of indecision. To go back and wander through the same dark, spider-haunted tunnels, his only light flickering into extinction, or to make his way across the roaring inferno of the foundry floor, and from there, who could know, which should it be? He will be king of underground, lord of the weeping shades. No, his people are gone. Let him be. He smacked himself on the head, trying to dispel the chittering voices. If I'm going to die, he decided, wresting back the mastery of his speeding heart, at least let it be in the light. He bent over, head throbbing, to stare at the cupped gleam of the crystal sphere. Even as he looked, the light died, then throbbed back into tenuous life. He slipped it into his pocket. The furnace flame and the dark shapes that passed before them laid pulsing stripes of red, orange, and black along the wall. He dropped down from the archway to huddle beside the downsloping ramp. The nearest hiding place was a shabby brick structure, some 15 or 20 ells from where he crouched, a disused kiln or oven that squatted on the chamber's fringe. After a few deep breaths, he bolted for it, half running, half crawling. His head ached from the motion, and when he reached the bulky kiln, he had to lower his face between his knees until the black spots went away. The harsh roar of the feeding furnace rang like thunder inside his head, silencing even his voices with its painful clamor. He made his way from dark place to dark place, little islands of shadowed safety in the ocean of smoke and red noise. The foundry men did not look up and see him. They barely communicated among themselves, limited in the crushing din to broad gestures, like armored men in the chaos of battle. Their eyes, points of reflected light above the masking cloth, seemed instead to stare at one thing only, the bright, compelling glow of hot iron. Like the red map line that still snaked a wistful course through Simon's memory, the radiant metal was everywhere, and all the same, like a dragon's magical blood. Here it splashed over the edge of a vat, spattering in gem-like drops. Over there it wound serpent-like away across the rock to flow hissing into a pool of brackish water. Great tongues of incandescence sluiced down from buckets, coloring the bundled foundrymen in demonic scarlet. Creeping, scuttling, Simon made his slow way around the rim of the smelting cave until he reached the nearest ramp leading out of the chamber. The oppressive, breathing heat and his own sickened spirit urged him to climb up, but the packed earth of the ramp showed a deep, criss-crossing scrawl of cartwheel tracks. This was a much-used doorway, he reasoned, thoughts blurry and slow. It was not a place he should try. At last he reached a mouth in the cavern wall that had no ramp. It was a difficult scrabble up the smooth, fire-melted, dragon-melted rock, but his flagging strength held up long enough for him to pull himself over the lip and collapse full length in the sheltering shadows just inside, the unpocketed sphere glowing weakly in his hand like a trapped firefly. When he knew who he was once more, he was crawling.
On your knees again, moon calf.
The blackness was virtually complete, and he was moving blindly downward. The tunnel floor was dry and sandy beneath his hands. He crawled for a long, long time. Even the voices began to sound as if they felt sorry for him.
Simon, lost. Simon, lost. Lost. Loss.
Only the slowly diminishing heat behind convinced him he was actually moving. But toward what? Where? He crept like a wounded animal, through solid shadow, heading down, always down. Would he crawl downward to the very center of the world? Scuttling leggy things beneath his fingers meant nothing now. The darkness was complete inside and outside. He felt himself almost bodiless, a bundle of frightened thoughts bumping down into the cryptic earth. Somewhere, sometime later, the darkened sphere he had clutched for so long that it seemed a part of him began to glow again, this time with a strange azure light. From a core of pulsing blue, the light expanded until he had to hold the sphere away from him, squinting. He climbed slowly to his feet and stood panting, his hands and knees tingling where they no longer touched sand. The tunnel walls were covered in fibrous black growths, tangled as uncombed wool. But through the twining strands gleamed shining patches, reflecting the new flowered light. Simon hobbled closer to investigate, drawing his hand back with a thin wheeze of disgust as he touched the greasy, black moss. Some of his self had come back with the light, and as he stood swaying, he thought about what he had crawled through and trembled. The wall beneath the moss was covered in some kind of tile, chipped and scored in many places, missing in others, so that the dull earth showed through. Behind him, the tunnel sloped upward, the rut of his passage stopping where he now stood.